and that amount of power in my receiving device if I make polarization error in my receiving device. In theory, if I've got a good polarimeter, a really state-of-the-art radio telescope, which can measure the amount of horizontal and vertical and the phase angle between the two. So therefore, it can find out how much is horizontal, how much is vertical, how much is clockwise, and how much is counterclockwise. If my sensing device is a thoroughly polarimetric type of sensing device, I will always see the power of that surface, of that bubble, in that direction when I'm doing the sensing. So I can mistune my sensor, but you put 100 watts into that antenna, and if it's made out of high-efficiency material, it's radiating 100 watts. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, we know that the total power in that situation is 100 watts, but the thing that you're making a visualization here is in terms of bubbles. I can explain it in terms of light and light polars, but because the wavefronts are specifically different. Traditionally, we think of something as horizontal as, you know, across on a plane, something vertical on a plane. No. You're describing bubbles. Bubble, the word bubble, maybe the nomenclature is the problem here. Bubble means spherical and round. Right? And you're not saying whether that the energy in the bubble is in any particular plane, okay? Maybe what you're saying is I'm shooting a cannon, and I'm moving the cannon in a horizontal direction, and my bubbles are coming across the line, or I'm shooting my bubbles out in a vertical direction, and the bubbles are coming out on a vertical plane. You're not exactly saying that, so your communication, your description here, not give me a sense of what's actually happening in free space with these bubbles. We're using a physical description, but you're not giving me anything clear that says that's what makes this polarization happen, so to speak. Maybe I'm wrong, but try and make me understand this a little better.
Hey, you've asked a good question, Eric, and I've got a vocabulary problem here. When I'm talking about these balloons that are being expanded, or bubbles being expanded, I'm trying to represent both the amplitude domain of energy and direction and the time domain. If I'm doing this experiment where the first nanosecond when the signal is turned on, and I've closed the switch and the signal is coming into the antenna, and I watch the very first waveform coming off that antenna, I will see an expanding bubble of energy. I'm standing off at a long distance, and I'm assuming this is an isotropic antenna, and this isotropic antenna is radiating 100 watts, because I'm putting 100 watts into it, but the 100 watts is not radiated on the first cycle. The signal, every reasonable antenna...
It's got to resonate first.
No, it always has its resonance. It's got a certain rise time. Every antenna has a certain finite Q. Therefore, it has a predictable rise time. The very first cycle coming off that antenna is a little bit weak. Doesn't have 100 watts into it, because I haven't gone through the rise time yet. 10 cycles downrange, the 10th bubble inside of each other, they're all concentric, they're all expanding at the speed of light. The 10th bubble is going to be at full brilliance. The first bubble, I'm watching this slow motion movie, is going to be kind of dim. The second bubble is going to be a little bit brighter. The third bubble inside of that is a little brighter again. I'm looking at the rise time. These bubbles are simultaneously giving me energy of the surface being radiated and pattern. The signal is coming off the antenna in all directions in a perfectly round bubble or balloon that's being expanded at the speed of light. Now, when I start using antennas that have directivity, certain portions of that bubble are brighter. There's more energy in that direction. But the timing of the signal coming off the antenna in the direction of the main lobe and the timing of the signal in the side lobes and the back lobes is the exact same timing. It's the exact same diameter at that instant of the bubble. So I'm trying to show time domain and the real way the energy is being radiated from the antenna. The antenna patterns we all see in the book is a representation of amplitude versus direction. Your eye would not see that pattern. The pickle-shaped pattern in three-dimensional space of the main lobe of a Yagi antenna. cucumber shape. Your eye would not see a cucumber shape. You would see a spherical wavefront that is brighter where the peak of the cucumber is, if you know what I mean. So I'm trying to represent time domain and spatial domain simultaneously before we get into polarization. And it's easy to make a polarization error between your transmitter and receiver where you see less energy. It doesn't change.
Repeater, timeout.
The polarization mismatch does not change the shape or the timing of the bubbles. Only changes their apparent amplitude because you've got a mistuned receiver. Maybe that's a little bit clearer. So the bubbles are trying to show spatial characteristic of a radiated signal, and they're trying to simultaneously show the time domain at the instant I turn on the transmitter and I watch the antenna go through its rise time. And each of those bubbles get brighter and brighter until I come up to full amplitude of that rise time. I wonder if that makes a little bit of help there, Eric. KE2EJ, 2RIW, the tech man.
2RIW, KE2EJ. Now you're starting to make sense, but I think there's got to be a better way to describe this. There's a lot of ambiguity in the words, so to speak. And I can relate it to some of the things that we do in terms of time domain and spatial response in terms of how we make pictures and stuff like that. That's not really relevant, but the map would be similar. I'm beginning to get the idea. I mean, I've understood what the patterns were and how they were generated, but you just added a little bit of a magic ingredient that really helps the brain kind of put the pieces together that you don't normally connect. Although there's got to be a better way of describing it. Move on. K2RIW, K2K.
In your world, Eric, where you use a lot of lasers which have extremely high directivity, these bubbles are much more difficult to envision. If you're trying to show an isotropic antenna at radio frequencies or a dipole-like antenna, and you want to, assuming that the human being is able to slow down the movie and watch the turn on of the transmitter and watch the signal being radiated by the dipole standing off at a long distance, what words would you use, Eric, to try to tell a new person what that energy of the signal coming off the dipole, what it would look like? If your eyes were tuned to radio frequencies, and if it was a slow motion movie, you could slow down the time, and the signal just got turned on of that antenna, what do you believe is the right way to convey that concept as to what the person would see as he sees the signal starting to come off that antenna? KE2EJ, K2YW.
All right. Let me just say this. The fact that you said that the system, not necessarily the antenna itself, the system has a slew rate in terms of how fast it brings up the maximum energy. That then begins to leave you with the problem of, multiple cycles reaching to a peak. But now you've reached the peak. Does it continue? Does it fall off and then start again? That little bit of information is sort of missing there. Mathematically, I can think of a couple ways to deal with that in terms of the wavefront itself. But here we're talking about something that's a different shape. So I'd have to think about that for a little while to try and come up with maybe my concept of what the explanation is.
Yeah, you got to be a little bit careful here now, Eric. Each individual cycle of the RF energy is a pure sine wave. In the case of a rise time of an antenna, and that rise time might take 10 consecutive cycles before the antenna comes up to full rise time, even though you've got a perfect coaxial switch turning on the signal on your coax cable going to the antenna. The antenna cannot come up to full amplitude because it's got a finite Q. Everything with a finite Q has got a finite rise time. And as such, the first sine wave comes up to a certain amplitude. The second sine wave is stronger in amplitude. So we're not talking about the degree-by-degree breakdown of an individual sine wave and its amplitude. We're talking about the first full 360 degrees of the first sine wave.
Yeah, but each sine wave still goes through zero, doesn't it?
Yes, and now each surface of my bubble, I can decide to make the surface of the bubble representing the positive peak of the sine wave, the negative peak of the sine wave, or the the amount of energy of the zero crossing. In either case, I can decide what my bubble represents. But my bubbles, the brightness of the bubbles represent an amplitude of whatever I've chosen to display. Maybe my bubbles are only showing the positive peak of each individual sine wave. I'm still going to see that exact same pattern, the exact same expanding bubbles or balloons, and they're going to get brighter as you go more cycles downrange because of the finite rise time of each individual full cycle. Be careful not to break this down to a degree number 10 and degree number 11 of a 360 degree sine wave. Don't go that fine. Just talk about the amount of peak amplitude of the first sine wave and the higher peak amplitude of the second sine wave, the second bubble. KE2EJ, K2RI,
hi. We're making things a little bit clearer now, but as we know, every resonant circuit has this ability to. Here's where some people are going to get confused, is that when you get to the positive peak and that sine wave that you're exciting your antenna with begins to drop, there's still some stored energy there. So really what you're describing is the cannon, let's say, is projecting individual bubbles that don't connect to one another, so to speak, one bubble, then the next, then the next, and each bubble having its energy at a higher level at some point on the bubble, and lower at another point of the bubble, something like that. Can we go that way?
Assuming now I've made all of my bubbles only show the positive peak of the voltage coming off the dipole, of what's being radiated. And now the brightness of this bubble tell me how much energy is radiated in the signal and how many watts total is being radiated by the antenna. However, be careful now. The standing wave structure of your dipole has, if I put 10 watts into the dipole and it's got a Q of 10, the total amount of radiated power is 10 joules per second. But at one instant of time, because it's got a Q of 10, somewhere the voltage is 10 times higher, somewhere the current is 10 times higher. That's what Q of 10 means. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance. At the peak of voltage on the dipole, peaks on the tips of the dipole, current in the center at that time is maximum. There's a lot of 1/2 Li squared stored magnetic energy in the center of that dipole. As the dipole goes from positive peak toward negative peak, and it goes through zero crossing. When it goes through zero crossing, the voltage between the two tips is zero. It doesn't mean zero energy. There's still a hell of a lot of magnetic energy in the center of that dipole. Because of the dipole, we drop. Even though I'm putting 10 watts into the antenna and I'm radiating 10 joules per second, because it's got a Q of 10, there's 10 times, there's 100 joules of stored energy in that dipole. One instant of time, more of it is electrostatic, and at another instant of time, a quarter wavelength later, more of it is magnetic. The total energy in the dipole is 100 joules at each second because it's got a Q of 10. The total energy in the dipole doesn't go through zero. Whether the voltage is stored at that instant in a voltage manner or in a current manner doesn't matter. It's still got a finite amount of energy, 100 joules of energy in my example, bouncing back and forth in that dipole, creating this complicated waveform. By a similar technique, if I've got an LC filter, an LC a capacitor across an inductor, and at the instant the voltages peak, all the energy is in the capacitor. At the instant the voltage goes through zero and there's no voltage on the capacitor, all the current is in the inductor. The total energy in that LC circuit stays constant, even though it's going through zero. At each instant of time, there's more energy in the capacitor. At another instant of time, there's more energy in the inductor. The total energy in that LC resonator is constant during those two cycles. KE2EJ, K2RIW, ain't that crazy?
Coming.
Crazy is not. I mean, that principle we use just about everything. It's from radio, it's the power distribution, everything else. That kind of brings you a picture that's a little bit clearer. But now, once we've moved the antenna and we're in free space, that's where the visualization brings issues in terms of understanding. But short of that point, no, I understand fully. It's just the relationship. relationship to the description of the bubble that's troublesome, that's all. Because as you said, if you let's just imagine one polarization where the positive peaks light up a certain part of the bubble. You're describing the bubble as a physical device, or a physical existence. What you're really saying is that if my bubble was a light, let's say, the light would be bright on one side, dim on the other, so to speak. I follow exactly what you're saying, and maybe one day I'll think of a better way of describing it. It makes perfect sense, though, Dave. Keep trying, though. You can't do it again.
Yeah, this is far from a perfect description, but I think it goes, there are certain people who hear the bubble description, and it gives them a little bit more insight as to what's going on in the antenna in its radiating process. And so, it's not simple, but it does give you some more information than you usually see in the antenna books. Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead with your comment, Wes.
Your part of the field is electrostatic. In order for you to have an electrostatic charge or field, but you need to specify which one we're talking about. You need to have an electric charges that are hung in time frame. Otherwise, you have a flow. When you have a flow, you have no electrostatic field. And to achieve.
If I start breaking down a full 360-degree cycle of the orogenic energy flowing inside of a dipole during the time I'm transmitting, at one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole, the tip has a positive peak of voltage, the left-hand side has a negative peak in voltage, and the voltage in the center of the dipole at that instant is close to zero. 90 degrees later, the voltage between the tips goes to zero, but the current in the center is maximum. So you've got stored magnetic energy, and you've got stored electrostatic energy, and they bounce back and forth in a way similar to what happens inside of an LC resonator. And there are times when the current is flowing, there are times when it stops flowing and reverses in direction. There's a whole lot of action going on there. So, Joe, you've asked one hell of a question tonight. I know you haven't gotten a nice, simple answer that you were looking for. Hopefully we've all came a little bit further. And by the way, Christopher, KD2KXG, was telling us we're spending too much time on this subject. He wants us to move on. He wants to control what we discuss on the TechNet. And the definition is technical net. We get into technical discussions. There are times when we go much too deep for some people's pleasure. And they've got an on-off switch on the rig. If it turns them off, they're able to go to another frequency or to turn off the rig. There are times we discuss things in a very simple manner, depending on the subject. Antennas are so darn important. Antennas are so strongly misunderstood. From time to time, I believe it is worthwhile to dig deeper into an antenna. Of course, not everyone's going to agree with that. And sometimes we spend too much time on it. Well, if you always go to the simple answer, you're always going to get a whole lot of misunderstanding of what an antenna is and how it works.
Repeater, time out.
A person can decide, I don't want to hear the fine details of what's going on inside of an antenna. I don't want to know that. I want to stay ignorant on that subject. That's your choice. There are a small number of very curious people, Mike and Joe and I and Eric, and I can list 10 more people, really want to know what's going on because they'd like to have the ability to design antennas to maximize the performance, to figure out what's going on, and why do they behave in crazy ways at some times. So people want to know what's going on with an antenna. Arguably, the antenna is the most important part of a radio circuit. You can have a gold-plated transmitter and a platinum receiver and the best possible transmitter and the best possible receiver in the world. If you don't connect the transmitter to a transmitting antenna and the receiver to a receiving antenna, you've got nothing when it comes to radio signaling is concerned. So arguably the antenna is the most important part. The antenna is arguably the most misunderstood part. The courses teaching us antennas do a terrible job because it's so difficult. It's not their fault. The books do a terrible job. I've been earning my keep as an antenna designer for a good fraction of my occupational life, so to speak, and I've acquired certain rules of thumb that work for me, and I'm trying to convey some of those rules of thumb to you. A person who's good at antenna design has gotten there by way of a 10 or 20 year apprenticeship working for a good company doing antenna design. You don't walk out of any of the respected schools with the ability to design antennas. That's an opinion. Look what you spotted tonight, Joe. The B2LY, get your eyes on it. But back to you, Joe, for your final.
Okay, should you be able to comment?
All of this came about very simply because I use a low band radio in the car, 52 megahertz and 6 meters. It also has 46 meg frequencies in it. Sometimes I use the right antenna on the car that resonates at 52 meg, and I can hear signals at 46 megs, you know, reasonably well, base mobile type communications. When I put the quarter wave antenna on for high band and on the same mount, I do that because it's easy for me to back my car in the garage without taking the antenna off, and sometimes I do it just for convenience. I notice that the signals don't seem to diminish really that much of what I hear on 46 megahertz. I would bet that if I measure the return loss of that antenna, that quarter wave 2 meter antenna at 46 megahertz, I would find the return loss to be atrocious. Maybe 1, 2, 3 dB return loss type of figure. That's what made me bring up this question, Dick.
And if you were looking at a known calibrated signal on 46 megs versus 150 megs, and you're looking at the S meter, you would see that extra loss. But at 46 megs, so to speak, or at lower frequencies, HF frequencies, although the antenna has extra loss because of high standing wave ratio, it's receiving less signal, less noise, but because the signal is weaker, your automatic gain control of your receiver starts cranking up the gain, and what you see, what you hear coming out of the loudspeaker sounds the same. That's one way of when I word that a receiver is extremely forgiving at HF frequencies. You can be using an antenna that has a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio on HF frequencies, and because you're lowering the signal and the noise, when you hear out of the loudspeaker and your automatic gain control takes over for the fact the signal is weak, when you hear coming out of the loudspeaker, sounds the same. You could say that the receiver is very forgiving. Try to transmit it into that antenna that's very poor, high in this one, you'll find great difficulty. So you could say a transmitter is persnickety and the receiver is very forgiving, but there's more going on there. At HF frequencies, you can get away with murder. You can take a clip lead of wire that's 3 feet long, connected to the antenna conductor of the UHF technic coming out of the back of your receiver, and listen on 80 meters, and you'll hear some beautiful signals. The signal strength meter will not move very much, but what you hear sounds beautiful, because you heard less signal and less noise from the ionosphere, and the signal-to-noise ratio still sounded beautiful. John, you want to make a comment on all of the above, and my guess is you're getting some chat room people saying, why in the world are they dwelling so long on this subject? BC2WGB, K2IW in the deck, man.
BC2WGB, well, I'm going to make it worse because I have questions. But pick up UPS. Rich has a comment.
Now, good old Rich, K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. There's one of the guys who's got high curiosity. Is one of the guys who does a lot of antenna experiments. He's used all kinds of QRP-like antennas in difficult locations and gotten high performance out of them because he knows to resonate the antenna is a hell of a lot more important than making it exactly the right physical length and making it the highest possible circuit in the world. There are times when he's on a beachfront, so to speak, with his homebrew antenna, which is getting beautiful performance, because he understands the concepts involved. So it is my belief that you're a guy with a lot of curiosity about antennas, Rich, and you responded by building them and testing them and finding out really what goes on. K2 UPS, are you in Pennsylvania? K2 RW in the TechNet? You got it, Rich.
K2 UPS, good evening, Dick. Yes, I'm near Washington, Pennsylvania, the southwest corner. But no, my comments were about the gentleman who broke in. I think you misunderstood his comment. He was not berating you for talking too much about antennas. I heard him say this was his first time tuning into it, first time hearing the TechNet, and he was curious if you discussed things other than antennas. I don't think he was telling you to, you know, change the topic. So I think maybe you jumped on him a little too hard there. That was my comment. Back to you.
Easy with the comments. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rich. There are times when I've told by lots of people we get too deep into subjects. And that's what I thought I was hearing. I shouldn't have jumped that way. Christopher, accept my apology. I shouldn't have said what I said. K2 UPS. Here's a man who knows how to explain antennas real simply. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Al.
That's K2RIW, TechNet, K6DPZ. I had three phone calls simultaneously. Yeah, well, as a general, I didn't hear what he said, but the TechNet consists much more of just antennas. Dick is a specialist in antennas, very knowledgeable man. I'm a specialist in many parts of the communication field, and if you ask any questions, if it's not involving antennas, I may come in and give answers to a very broad field. I've been in almost 60 years. I design communications equipment. I hold quite a few patents. So that did not mean to chop your head off. I'll go ahead, back to that. K2RWK6DPC.
Okay, thank you, Hal. John, number two, we've kept you waiting an awful long time. Hope we haven't put you to sleep. KD2, India X-ray Papa, K2RW. You got it, John. Okay.
Question.
And also, Dick.
What was that, John?
I had a question also. I just let Rich go ahead.
And I have a question.
Okay, let's go back to you then, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Well, I have a few assumptions, and I want to see if I'm correct. If we have an isotropic antenna, Dick, we can assume that all of the bubbles that are generated, this is just an isotropic antenna, perfect one, all of the bubbles that are generated are reinforced from the exact same center as they expand. Is that correct?
Not quite. If I've gone through the 10 cycles of the rise time, and each individual cycle now is coming out with the same amplitude, the cycle, I'm going to give it cycle number 20, because I'm radiating 10 watts, the total bubble cycle number 20 has 10 watts of energy in it, 10 joules per second, so to speak. As the bubble expands, it still has exactly 10 watts of energy. It just now spread over a larger area, you know, 4 pi r squared is the area of a sphere. So as that bubble gets larger, the inverse square law means that you see less energy in your finite receiving antenna. Your receiving antenna may have a radio area of 1 square meter. And if you're 1 mile away from it, you get a certain signal strength. If you go 2 miles away from it, you get 1/4 of that signal strength. Not because the energy truly drops off per se. It's because the bubble got larger, a 1 mile distance versus a 2 mile distance. The 2 mile bubble, so to speak, has got twice the amount of surface area. Therefore, you see, is that right? Yes. It's got four times the surface area. Therefore, you see four times less power. So the total energy of each bubble is the same. It's just being spread over a larger and larger area as the bubble gets bigger. Each individual bubble is not being supported by the inner bubbles or the later ones. Each individual bubble is a thoroughly separate event. You launch that particular bubble with a certain amount of energy. Assuming that free space is lossless, the energy in that total bubble never changes. That's my opinion on that one, John. K2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB, but the emanating power coming from that isotropic antenna is always starting at the center of that bubble, all right? It doesn't reinforce but they all started at same point, correct?
If you do a slight simplification, and you assume that your isotropic antenna is a point source of energy, the first 2 inches away from that antenna, there's a very strong local magnetic field and electrostatic fields and whatever that will drive you crazy. But you get into the far field of the antenna. In the case of a simple isotropic antenna, when you're 1 or 2 wavelengths away, you're in the far field. And from there out to infinity, each individual bubble is a perfectly spherical object of your isotropic antenna. The intensity of the bubble, because it's an isotropic antenna, in every direction, they have the exact same amount of brightness, and the amount of energy in bubble number 45, and the amount of energy in bubble number 91, is the exact same amount of energy, just that bubble number 91 got launched later, and so at this instant of time, it's smaller, and therefore the watt per square meter is larger, but the total amount of energy in each bubble is the same if I've got a steady-state transmitter. Each individual bubble, you could say, does not see the inner and outer bubbles. They're not supporting each other in any way. Each individual bubble is moving out at the speed of light. Each individual bubble is launched with a certain amount of energy. Each bubble in a lossless free space, each bubble keeps that exact same amount of energy, even as it gets larger. And by inverse square law, 4 pi r squared is the surface area, the energy falls off of 60 dB per octave, 4 to 1 distance, 4 to 1 single strength increase versus range, because the surface area is increasing, 4 pi r squared. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, I understand that, Dick, but I'm not explaining my question properly, I guess. The point it emanates from, that antenna, if the antenna is not moving, all of the new points of energy that have developed within bubble, are right in the center point where the first one emanated from, correct?
Absolutely right. And I'm going to reword that. All of the bubbles are concentric if the source is not moving. Thank you, John.
Okay, now if all bubbles are concentric, my question is, if we look at the radiation pattern as, let's take a pancake and hang it with a string through it, and we spin it, we have a bubble. Now we're looking at this rotating pancake. Now if we look at the actual end of the pancake, we're looking down the thread. If we had photometric lenses on our eyes, and as it rotated, we would see that energy level rise and fall, correct? Due to the brightness in that pancake plane.
You said you had a pancake with a thread going through it. You didn't tell us, even though it's clear in your mind, you didn't tell us, or outside of your mind, whether or not the string is going through the pancake in a perpendicular manner, or is the string parallel to the surface of the pancake? I'm going to assume you're saying that the string is parallel to the surface of the pancake. So the pancake, now, if the string is vertical, the pancake is edgewise vertical to the ground, and now you're rotating it on that string. And I guess you're considering that horizontal polarization. And if that was a radiating pancake, there's a zillion different ways I could put signal onto that. Assuming the pancake is now a conducting copper surface, there's a zillion ways I could put signal onto that copper surface and rotate it. I can give you all kinds of crazy intense patterns and polarization. So there's a lot of missing information here with your pancake visualization, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
KC2WGB. Sorry for the poor explanation on this question, but okay, yes, the string is hanging vertically, and it has a pancake attached to it. Now we're going to look down the axis of the string. The information is the pancake shape. So as it's rotating and we have our bubble, as we look with the polarized glasses, we will see that energy where it's bright and it goes dim. Would that be correct?
And believe it or not, there's some further ambiguities here, John. When you're looking down the axis of the string, of this pancake that's parallel to the string and glued to it. And the pancake is rolling, rotating. And by now, make the pancake into a dipole-like structure, but it's being rotated. I'm now creating a kind of circular polarization. A rotating antenna structure, if it's rotating at the carrier frequency, and I look down the string, that is a method of generating circular polarization. So now if I'm looking down the string, and I've got a horizontal sensing antenna or a vertical sensing antenna, I'm going to see the exact same amount of signal at various distances of time. And if I break down each individual cycle in 1 degree at a time, but if I'm looking at a complete cycle, whether my antenna is horizontal or vertically polarized, looking down the string, I'm going to see the exact same amount of energy of a complete cycle. You're really generating circular polarization with that rotating pancake, I think, if you're rotating it at the carrier rate, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
KC2WGB, very good. No, that's the idea. But now, because we have this device on our eyes, which is polarized, we should see a variance as that turns. If that's our light source that you mentioned before, it's a little brighter in the right direction. Now, as that pancake turns, we're going to see it get bright and dim as it turns in that circular pattern. No?
Yes. But bear in mind now that every pancake represents, every bubble that I described earlier, represents a peak of energy that you're sensing, that you call at the surface of the bubble. I might decide that the surface of my bubbles represents the positive peak of voltage radiated by the dipole. It's only the positive peaks that I'm calling the surface of the bubble. And I'm now standing at some distance and the bubbles are hitting me. I'm going to watch the bubble give me a positive peak on my sensing antenna. I'm going to watch it go through zero. I'm going to see a negative peak in between that bubble and the next bubble. And when the next bubble comes along, I'm going to see a positive peak again. All radio waves, no matter whether they're horizontal, vertical, circular, polarized, they really have to electronically, what you receive in your transmission line, has to go through a sine wave of cycle of positive voltage, zero voltage, negative voltage, and so on. There's got to be a sine wave of radio signal at the carrier frequency. When you're transmitting antenna, when you're receiving antenna, when they're working correctly, you're always going to see a sine wave. And now whether the sine wave peaks at certain times, depending on whether or not you're using horizontal, vertically sensing antenna, there's a whole lot of other crazy things going on here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay. Yep, that answers all my questions. It was interesting to look at the circular polarization. If it was at each, say, 1 degree mark, it was there long enough to go through one cycle. If we had those polarized glasses on, we could watch that slow turn give us bright lines and dim lines as it travels through that 360 degrees. I just wanted to make sure I had that concept right.
Let me warn you here, though, John, that among the people who have done antenna design for 10 or 20 years, a certain percentage of them have a great deal of difficulty understanding the innards of what's going on with circular polarization. Essentially, every circular polarized antenna really has a horizontal radiating element and a vertical radiating element inside the antenna. They're displaced by 90 degrees in the time domain. One of them's got another quarter wavelength of transmission line going to it. So that, very similar to what I can do with my oscilloscope. If I've got horizontal deflecting plates and vertical deflecting plates, and I put the exact same voltage on both, sine wave of voltage, but I make one voltage 90 degrees ahead of the other, I'll draw this perfect a circle on the oscilloscope. To some degree, circular polarization is like that. So inside of the antenna, the horizontal sensing portion of the antenna senses the horizontal peak, the vertical portion of the antenna senses the vertical peak, and those two different peaks occur at a different period of time in that sub-element of the antenna. but then the transmission line has an extra 90 degrees of wavelength on one antenna versus the other, and therefore, when they get summed, they come back together in phase, and therefore you see a beautiful sine wave coming out of your circular polarized receiving antenna. But there really was a separate horizontal element and a separate vertical element in almost every circular polarized antenna when you get down to the nitty-gritty inside. Over to you, John. KQIAW.
KC2WGV. Very good, Dick. Yes, it's clear to me. And I guess we can get off the subject and go to Webb. Sorry to bore people. Back to you, Dick.
Yes. You're after Wes, Eric. And Wes, you're not on the list of people that we're going to go to. So if you're asking a question for clarification on what we discussed up till now, very good. If you're asking a brand new question now, Wes, that's a little bit unfair. N2XJN, K2MIW.
6DPZ with a comment. Can I get in, Dick?
When you go at the end of the list, we got Wes, and Eric, and Hal in that order. We're not going to put you ahead of everybody else. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, Dick, you decide. You were talking about antennas, polarization, and electromagnetic radiation, electromagnetic force. So if I have a question that is side of that, but still is about the electromagnetic wave, would that be inappropriate to ask this question at the issue?
Yeah, if you were asking for clarification on what we've discussed up till now, that would be okay. If you're asking a brand new question, so to speak, on propagation, that's what we've discussed up till now, so it's a little bit unfair. We've got to go down the list first. Now, the next person on the list of people making a comment was Eric, K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking about this a little bit. How about this, for example? Let's not define voltage and current, but let's just say the bubbles that are emanating from the antenna, we're going to visualize it. Let's think of it as a globe, which has lines of longitude and latitude, just for the sake of it, for the sake of visualization. Whereas at one polarization, the energy gradient travels along the equator, and then the other polarization, or the vertical, the energy gradient runs from pole to pole. How's that as a way of visualizing where the energy is in the bubble?
Yeah, if you go to the right chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, all four editions, and you look at the section called the Poincaré sphere, Mr. Poincaré, I think a French mathematician, has found a way of taking a sphere with latitude lines and longitude lines, and he's managed to describe all senses of antenna polarization. All linear polarizations are on the equator. All circular polarizations, clockwise is on the south pole, and counterclockwise is on the north pole. And as you choose a latitude somewhere between the equator and the poles, you're now choosing somewhere between a linear polarization and circular polarization, which is elliptical. And by the way, all those linear polarizations on the equator at the prime meridian might be purely vertical, and at the international date line is purely horizontal. So polarizations along the equator, every longitude represents some amount of tilt of linear polarization. So Mr. Poincaré has found a way of using a sphere of the Earth to describe all possible polarizations of an antenna. Let me drop. And one of the very valuable things that he came up with is the so-called antipodal characteristic. Choose any point on that sphere that represents a particular sense of elliptical polarization. And you go to the antipodal point on that sphere, and now you have the exact orthogonal polarization where the two antennas have no response to each other. So I can have a purely elliptical polarization that's halfway between the equator and the north pole, along the prime meridian, so to speak, and I choose the antipole, halfway between equator and north pole, I choose the antipodal position at the international date line, halfway between the equator and the south pole, Those two points, the antipodal points, are exactly orthogonal. It's hard to believe that in the elliptical polarization that has a certain amount of horizontal and vertical relative amplitude and a certain phase shift between the two, that with this antipodal characteristic of this Poincaré array sphere, I can now choose an antenna that has absolutely zero response to that signal of that crazy polarization. Ain't that something else? K2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. I was going to say something like that earlier, not specifically that, but the fact that it's orthogonal, it makes the visualization so much easier. All right, go on to the next guy. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, Al, you wanted to make a comment on all of the above. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. I am not going to make a comment on all of the above. What I would like to do is address the whole tech depth very simply. There are a lot of new amateur radio operators who have come to this fold. We have radio offers. Now, the tech depth, as far as I'm concerned, should not just have a point that everything is discussed primarily on antennas. There are the people on this TechNet, Nick, John, me, Eric, who have vast backgrounds in many aspects of amateur radio, a part of the hobby. And for a newbie, any newbie that's listening to this TechNet, come in, when they ask for questions, don't just ask about antennas. Ask about maybe power supply works, how to do some basic troubleshooting. You have a vast amount of people with knowledge, me with the least amount. That is my only comment, Dick, because I've been listening to this thing, and I feel that there are a lot of new people who have licenses, and they're just intimidated and afraid to come on. K6DPZ.
K6-2WGB. Well, we only answer the questions that are offered. These questions were asked, and that's what we're doing. If any other questions are available, please bring them on. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Your answer, John.
Yeah, when you go to that website of amateurradio.tango.com, where there are 10 solid years of TechNet recorded there, you will see many thousands of subjects that have been discussed over the years. I will admit that antennas are one of the frequently discussed subject, because the subject is so important and so highly misunderstood and so poorly taught in all of our schools, in my opinion. So you'll see thousands of subjects, some of them very simple.
Repeater, time out.
As I said, some of them very simple and some of them pretty complicated. And yet, by the nature of the name, the technical net, there are times when we do get quite technical. We're not doing that to intimidate people. For those who are really curious about that subject, we go into it and try to dispel some of the many, many misconceptions. My wife used to teach in a one-room schoolhouse in Leavenworth, Kansas, grades 1 through 8. You could easily say the child in the second grade is hearing some of the instruction that goes on for the 8th grade people, and that it was irrelevant to them. Not necessarily. There's an awful lot of advantage of a one-room schoolhouse, where you occasionally hear the information that's way above your head. But at least you become familiar with the vocabulary, become a little bit less intimidated when you finally get your specific instruction in that area. So the fact that you hear something that you don't understand, and by the way, all new information, the learning process, is going to be uncomfortable. If you're sitting in a classroom and you're very comfortable with what the teacher was saying, that means you already have some knowledge on that subject and you knew it ahead of time. If he's giving you brand new information you've never heard before, you're going to be uncomfortable. That's the nature of the educational process. You're hearing things and vocabulary and methods of expression you've never heard before. You can either go screaming out of the room saying, I don't want to hear this, I don't understand it, or you can sit there and say, yeah, I'm going to swallow this for now, I know I'm not digesting it yet, at some later time it's going to start making more sense to me. All new information is like that. It's uncomfortable at first. You can't get around that, in my opinion. I may be wrong, but that's an opinion. Get your eyes on you.
Hey, 1 second, Dick, okay?
Go ahead, Al.
Okay. Is there anybody on the tech deck at this time?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, you jumped the gun at the very beginning, Hal. You didn't wait for the beeps, so we didn't hear your question. You said, is there anybody on the TechNet at this time? Go ahead, Hal.
Is there anybody on the TechNet at this time who is listening to the TechNet, who is possibly a newbie, who would like to ask any questions not relevant to antennas or would like to get in to a discussion? K6DPZ. Address is K2RIW.
When are you directing this man?
Directing it? I'm trying to establish something. You have a problem?
Hal, in the very beginning of the TechNet, for the second year, for the second week in a row, I said that one of the complaints we receive is that the subjects at times seem a little bit difficult to understand, particularly for a newbie. And I specifically said, the fact that you've got what you think is too simple a question, you don't have a way of expressing it. We do not deny people asking simple questions. Please come forward and ask your question. Don't be intimidated. We don't have the elitist attitude of, hey, your question doesn't come up to our level. The dumbest question is the one most deserving of an answer. So we specifically said in the last 2 weeks in a row at the beginning that if you've got a simple question, go right ahead and ask it. Don't feel embarrassed by that. The next person who was on our list was Chet, KD2AHK. If we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Chet, go right ahead. KD2AHK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, okay. Perhaps I have a dumb question, but I'm happy to ask it. Totally different. I enjoyed the whole former description of antennas. Yes, it's quite complicated. Now I get the feeling by just some of the questions of other people that they also need a better way of getting it described. So let me go into my dumb question, which is totally off the normal ham radio question, but I did hear in the past things about furnaces and stuff, and I even enjoyed furnaces and how to tune them up. So let me drop and let me just ask my dumb question. Here we go.
Well done, Dutch. And we're looking forward to your dumb question. Sorry, I got your call letters wrong. WB2AHK. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW is in the tech.
All right, we're going to take a break. Totally different. All right, my question is about jet aircraft. Engines powering jet aircraft are described as having a certain amount of thrust in pounds. My angry question will be, what is thrust in pounds? Is there a direct relationship pound for pound, i.e. the weight of an aircraft versus the engine thrust? I can, for example, two engines each having a thrust of 100,000 pounds, therefore 200,000 pounds of thrust, with an aircraft weighing over 650,000 pounds. Let me let it drop for a second. Or is engine thrust and the weight of the aircraft not directly related? Would it not, in the case of an aircraft weighing, let's say for instance like a 777 Boeing, weighing 650,000 pounds, need an engine thrust at least equal to its weight to make it move? That's my question. Is thrust meaning is there a direct relationship in thrust and weight of an aircraft? What do you know about thrust, Dick? Over.
Yeah, good question, Chet. There's a relationship between the two, and it's not a direct, linear, simple relationship. If I took an engine that's rated for 10,000 pounds of thrust and I mounted on the engine testing stand with all kinds of strain gauges on it, and I turn on the engine full blast, I'm going to see a force of 10,000 pounds trying to move that engine even though it's tied down. An engine does create that amount of force. Now, depending on the lift-to-drag ratio, of the design of your particular wing of that airplane. If I'm using an extremely highly efficient wing, like I've got on a sailplane, where the sink ratio on a sailplane might be a number like 39, that means for each foot, when I'm flying my sailplane, I'm thoroughly calm, undisturbed air. For each foot that I move downward, that I lose altitude, I move 39 feet forward. If I've got a wing with a lift-to-drag ratio of 39. So there are cases where an extremely efficient wing requires very little thrust because of what the wing is doing. The wing is deflecting air downward. Very similar to what happens when you're using your water skis. Let me drop this. You know darn well that with your water skis sitting steady and you're not being towed through the water, you're sunk in that water up to your neck, and those water skis are underground, under the surface. Move me across the surface of the water where the water skis are deflecting water downward. Very similar to what a wing does. The main thing a wing does is it deflects air downward. All of a sudden, the amount of force on that polyethylene rope that's towing me, that force might be, let me pick a number, 25 pounds. That 25 pounds allows me to move forward and deflect water downward, even though I might be 180 pounds. So once again, as you can see, if I've got the right lift-to-drag ratio of my water skis or the wing of my airplane, depending on that lift-to-drag ratio, a hell of a lot less thrust is required than weight. If I'm flying straight and level, if I want the airplane to do a pure vertical rise, I have no choice. If the airplane is 100,000 pounds, you've got to have 100,000 pounds of thrust or you're never going to move purely vertical. And along those lines, it's very interesting to note that if you took an F-15 airplane that's lightly loaded with fuel and you aim it straight up and you go to full power, it will go straight up and break the sound barrier because its thrust is greater than its weight. So much less thrust is required on pure level flight if your wing is efficient enough. Darn good question there, Chet. WB2AHK, KQRIW in the TechNet.
All right, WB2AHK. Well, how does two engines each 100,000 pounds of thrust, 200,000 pounds, move from a stationary position? There's no effect from the wings yet. It's sitting at the parking spot, tow it out with a tug. They put it out in the apron someplace, and your pilot revs up 200,000 pounds of thrust, but the plane weighs 650,000 pounds. How does it actually break its static position? That's what I'm trying to say. Over.
Tell them about the second one.
Your automobile probably weighs more than 3,000 pounds. If your tires are fully inflated, and if you're on a straight, level parking lot, and your car is in neutral, and you push real hard on your car, your body can probably create 80 pounds of force, and you're moving a 3,000-pound automobile. That's the function of the wheel. If your wheel has efficient enough bearings, and the wheel is round enough, and the tire is not deflecting too much, in the case of steel wheels on a railroad car, my goodness, very little force is required to keep that railroad car moving forward. So the efficiency of a wheel allows you to move at right angles to gravity, and the weight tells you how fast it accelerates, you know, F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. How fast it speeds up, once you've got a very efficient set of wheels, that's a function of the mass of the object and how much force you're applying. But for steady state motion, with efficient enough wheels, the force required to keep it moving could be very small. And the force that you use as required when you start moving could be very small if you've got efficient enough wheels. But still, you're not going to jump up to full speed right away. The rate of acceleration is a function of mass and force you're using to move that mass. These are not easy subjects to to swallow the first time you hear him, Chet. Let me turn it back to you before we go over to anybody else. Let me meet you, AHK, K2IW. Does that make some sense so far?
Yes. Okay, so it's in the wheels because it rotates and takes less effort to move it, even though the aircraft weighs more than the maximum power of the engines. Okay, good. That's good. So, in other words, if it didn't have wheels, it just had some skids to move a 650,000-pound aircraft, you would need a thrust of over 650,000.